On this episode of the Film Crux Podcast, we have director and producer David Slade.
My theory of cinema is is that we all dream. And in those dreaming is our understanding of the code of cinema. And so that's why you understand so many things about certain films, I think, explicitly without having to talk it through.
Welcome to the Film Crux Podcast. I'm your host, Deontay Jenkins. Now, before we get into the fantastic conversation that I had with David Slade, I want to tell you about this amazing new product by Film Crux. It's called Film Crux Plus, and truthfully, it should be essential for any independent filmmaker out there in post-production. If you like any of the Film Crux products, you'll love this because it bundles them all together for just $10 a month. We're talking sound design, VFX, Foley, music, all together in one place for just $10 a month. If you're looking to step up the quality of your productions, go to filmcrux.com and check this out. You will not be disappointed, I promise you. Now, David Slade.
Where are you? Where are you physically in the world? Where, just can I ask that?
I'm in DC. Are you in LA now or London?
No, I was originally from England, but I've been living in Los Angeles for, good God, a long time. Made my first movie in 2004 that was Hard Candy, and so it was 2 years before that, so 2002. Yeah. I've been here a good 20 years, and so I'm essentially American, but I'm from the north of England.
Essentially.
And I spent 10 years in London before that, doing music videos and commercials before coming to America and making films and television and more commercials and that kind of thing.
I see now that you're doing a lot more television than actual films, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I am lucky that I'm able to do projects which are just really exciting and fun, and that's how I choose my projects. So, and these days particularly, it's difficult to finance ideas that are complicated and sometimes weirder in movies than it is on television. So shows like Black Mirror, for instance, which I've worked on two of, become much more doable than
right.
Movies where it's just a very, very it's a very conservative market for a lot of films these days for medium budget particularly. So so I just go to wherever the really fun stuff is. And so I'm pretty, agnostic between films, and I have four projects right now, which are films, which are in process. I've got one film that I shot last year that's coming out at some point next year. And I'm also being offered television. So I just look at each project, on its own merits,
Yeah.
I just, a filmmaker and storyteller first, and so I go for, I'm lucky that each project that I've done by and large has been my dream project, right? So when you ask the question, like, what's your dream project? It's kind of the last thing I did usually. And I've managed to keep that streak going for quite a long time now. Part of that is being open to saying, well, this project's a television project. Would you do that?
And right.
In the case of Black Mirror, yeah, absolutely. I'd love to do that. And I've said no to a lot of TV, but I've done, shows where I've done the pilot as well. For example, Hannibal, on American, again, both dream projects. So, it's if you're making a dream for a living and you don't really kind of have to work really, although you do work much harder than you would have done had you had a real job. You know what I mean? It's
right. Definitely.
That's how I get through it. At least I have had real jobs.
Yeah.
I had a few. I worked in gas stations as a student and tire packing factories and all kinds of things. But yeah, that's good. Inspiration not to have to do that again. So,
yeah. For sure. So you talked about directing the pilot for Hannibal, and
sure, yeah.
You know, when you're working on a project like Hannibal versus Black Mirror, with a show that's already been established, what's the difference coming in to direct those type of things? You know, with like early on in a show, I would assume that the person that's directing and the cinematographer for the pilot episode are kind of establishing the tone and the look and everything like that.
Absolutely. You're totally spot on. That's exactly right. And so really looking through my career back, I have not been in a situation, with the exception of one episode I did of Breaking Bad, where I've had to walk into a set where a look has been set, because each of the Black Mirrors that I've done were standalone episodes. So they're like doing small movies.
Right, yeah.
There's nobody that came before you. There's no look to the show because each episode is standalone. So I've been afforded the freedom of a pilot director. So with Hannibal, I was the pilot director. So I set the look. I brought in, you know, the DOP, in that case, Jim Hawkinson, to shoot. And we set up the look of the film between us. That's Hannibal. And so then we sat down and we kind of, you know, I wrote a little black book of this is what we did, so that each director coming in could have access to that, saying, well, okay, so normally they would use this. Not that you'd have to strictly, but this, if you want to know how to maintain the look of the show, then these are the things we've done. These are the choices and these are the weapons we've taken to battle with. And these are, this is the reason we've used these particular you know, cameras, lenses, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, you're absolutely spot on. You know, so the pilot director is often in the same role as a movie director going in to make a movie. And when you do Black Mirror, it's exactly the same, because there is absolutely no obligation to follow the look of previous shows, because they're all individual stories. And that's kind of how it's worked for me, in the sense that I have been offered doing episodic work, but I always feel like I need to have that position of being able to set the look. Otherwise, why? I don't think I'd be very good at it, you know, like coming in and doing where it would be. So I I'm lucky enough that I haven't had to. So I, in terms of my career, I've always keep working on dream projects, but I have been offered some lovely television projects, but I have so far said no to all but one, which was right at the beginning, which was Breaking Bad. And that was, you know, it was a amazing show, and I was talking already with the showrunner writer about a possible film, and it was a quick way to get to work together for a little while.
With that, was it kind of difficult coming in, because television is a bit different than movies, whereas film, with movies, the director is the creative head of the team, you know what I mean? But with television, it's the showrunner, you know? So
yeah,
I know you've only done the one with Breaking Bad.
Well, but what they do, you know, when you come into a pilot, you're given equal, as a director, you're given equal billing to the showrunner. It's only if you're coming in later on. That because, you know, when in television, when they choose a director to come and do the pilot, they're directing somebody to set the look of the show, to set all the dials, right? So that everyone else comes in and steps into that. So if you're directing a pilot, you are essentially really in the same place as a movie director. The showrunner will then take on what you're doing and continue through, but I always collaborate really well with the showrunners. So yeah, Breaking Bad was the only time I've broken that mold, where I've actually gone into an existing format and shot it, you know. And it's fascinating. I found it really interesting to go in and say, well, I don't want this to suddenly look like a different show. I want it to look like this show. So let's see, why did you? Right. And it was great. It was like being a fan, and it was nice. And I only did it one time. And it was like being a fan. I was like, why do you use the 28 mil wide? Why? What's that about? Tell me why you do this. Tell me why. And, you know, they would always give me great, you know, give me the reasons they do it all. Be okay, great. Let's do it that way then. And I was still able somehow to put my own stamp on what I did, but not so much that it overtook, you know, that show, which was great. It fit. I think my episode fit in quite nicely with all the other episodes. And I think
a certain feel to it, for sure.
Yeah, there's a certain thing though about, I don't know. to me, I'm always cinematically driven. And what I mean by that is that the language of cinema is really important to me. So what do I mean by the language of cinema? I liken it to the language of dreams, which everybody knows because everybody's dreamed, right? So if you watch a movie for the first time in your life and suddenly you see time cutting to later, you know it's not just jarring. It's a thing that you've experienced in your dreams because dreams have time cuts in them. Sometimes two images might collide and telepathically send a third image to the viewer, who understands that that cut with that means something else. This,
right?
That's cinema. That's a cinematic language. So I am attracted to projects where that cinematic language is prevalent. In fact, I it's kind of a necessity to me. So things where, you know, the show is shot in a way where its coverage to overcome an obstacle to succeed in the end, and the language is kind of would get in the way, that wouldn't be something that would interest me anyway. So that would be how I'd go about choosing, you know, wanting to or not wanting to do a project like that. Does that make sense?
Now, with something like, you know, that made perfect sense. With something like, I know you directed one of the Twilight movies, which is almost having a franchise like that. You also have that kind of established thing. You know, is it similar with television?
Yeah, no, weirdly not actually. In that instance, they wanted someone to come in, and they didn't want everything changed, but they wanted a lot of things changed. They wanted improvements making if it could be. And so the only person I think that there was the DP, Javier Girasarobi, who had shot the second one, but he hadn't shot the first one, so there was no continuity there. But I kept him. Which seemed to make sense. But I'm very specific with the way I shoot, and I'm very precise about giving direction to camera. And so that didn't, it wasn't like there was any struggling with kind of wrestling a film in any direction. I storyboard very precisely, and I shoot the shots I do. And, you know, I would go to Javier and say, I'd love this to be, you know, wide open at a 1:4 and 75 mil tracking from here to here and starts here and goes from here to here. And we would talk about it, and he'd say, well, yeah, great, but the sun's over there. It'd be better if, you know, we could, I'd be, okay, great. Let's shift everything around and let's work that way. And that's how, you know, how it would go. So in a way, I was able to just do everything I needed to do. You know, there were, some of the things, there were some visual effects things where we, you know, I think we were able to improve because the technology had improved and they were okay. You know, the studio was fine with that. You know, there were some certain things though that where it was like, no, we're happy with the look of that thing. So don't change that. And all of that seemed fine to me. So it was a very weird, quick project, that one to do, and an odd one for me, more of an outlier, I think, in my career. But yeah,
Definitely. When I'm looking at your career, that definitely is an outlier. It doesn't necessarily fit in with the rest of the things that you've done.
But it was, they came to me and they said, you know, we did a vampire movie and you did a vampire movie. We think your vampire movie's better. Would you come into our vampire movie, which stars like a 15-year-old girl, and your first movie starred a 15-year-old girl? So it was really like they had. You know, it was all fairly compartmentalized to the studio. They were like, no, this is, makes sense. You've just done. If you add that your first two movies together, it makes this third movie, which is a
right.
with vampires. And I'm like, well, sure, if you like, I wouldn't have had me.
That's interesting how studios think. That's interesting.
That's exactly what was said at the time. They were like, yo, you know, you've done a, you know, thing with somebody Kristen Stewart's age, and you've done a vampire movie, and you've done them both very well. So come and do this. And I was like, okay.
If it works, it works.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not how, and the way you get a job is never how you think you're going to get a job. It's one of the things I've learned over the many, many years of doing this.
Hmm.
There's always some weird logic that you just didn't think of.
That's really different. You talked about the way you direct, especially working with camera. I've spoken to so many DPs and so many directors, and each of them have different perspectives on how the collaboration should work or how they would want it to work. And you sound like a more visually dominant director who has knowledge of both the technical and creative side of cinematography. Does that tend to rub some DPs the wrong way? Because I know a lot of DPs, I've spoken with a lot of DPs that get a little irritated when there are directors that know too much and they want to say, you know, have the camera wide open. I mean, have the lens wide open at a, you know, T2 or whatever,
well,
you know.
Well, it's a polite way to ask for that thing and ask for that and not give it, make it be a demand. I mean, I've never worked with a DOP where I've expected them to come and take my order, right? It's a collaboration and you choose your collaborator carefully and you work with somebody who you know is, I mean, you know, also visually, there's another part of the story which is to do with all of the aspects of cinema. So as far as I'm concerned, the more I know about acting, lighting, grip equipment, post-production, the better I can challenge everybody on my crew to give me a really strong, powerful shot that I want, that is very specific to what I want. But also because I understand, you know, because of my understanding, essentially, which has come from many years of doing it, I'm not asking them to do the impossible every time and then having, and then getting annoyed when they can't do it. So if I'm asking to shoot wide open, I know that that's going to be a very narrow depth of field and it's going to be really hard on the AC and that the camera movement is going to be really precarious and that I'm very fully aware. So when I go into those situations where I'm asking for those kinds of, that kind of specificity, I'm doing it with absolute respect for everyone involved. And I choose my collaborators right. Based on, you know, look, I've got this idea and I got a really clear vision of how I want to do it. So like my last film, I worked with a DOP called Larry Smith. Larry was Stanley Kubrick's last DP on Eyes Wide Shut. He was on Kubrick's team. He did, you know, he worked on The Shining. He worked in the camera department and the lighting department through most of Kubrick's films. And so it's quite an intimidating DOP to work with. Of the experience, you know, but I had a lovely conversation with him where I explained what I wanted to do and got really into technical detail about how I kind of wanted the film to look, and he just loved it. And mostly, I would say, mostly my experience, I just worked with Maddie Libatique on a commercial I just shot, also to work a lot with Darren Aronofsky. Mostly my experience with DOPs is the opposite, actually, is that they welcome the fact that you understand their department and that you're asking the best of their department, but not asking the impossible, and you're appreciating, you know, when you do something difficult, you really appreciate how difficult it is and give them the time to get it right.
Right.
You know, and give them the, you know, whatever the additional prep is to get that shot, because, you know, so I tend to think of it in a positive way, right? I didn't tend to see anyone on the crew as somebody who I'm asking to do a thing as anything other than a collaborative request. So yeah, I haven't really had that experience, although I can imagine it being something people come up with.
Yeah.
But usually, you know, I've had really good experiences with DOPs where there's a reason for why I'm asking what I'm asking for. I'm not just saying, I really want to do it. Just
yeah.
I'm asking for the 1:4 because I want the fall off on the lens to be so shallow that you can't see the thing that's the scariest. It's there. The focus is not going to go to that. The focus is going to stay. It's going to drift to it, but it's not going to go to it. And that's going to bring internal attention to the film. And this is part of the cinema language, and that's why I'm asking for a 1:4 specifically. And it can be a 2:8 or whatever. You know,
I think that's the key, though. I think a lot of people don't realize when the director is designing the shots, and a lot of people don't realize that the director does design the shots of the film. I don't think a lot of people, especially a lot of new directors, and a lot of people that don't know the process of filmmaking, sure, I think they get caught up with the things look cool type of thing rather than this fits for the mood and the moment of the story.
Yeah. I can't speak to that because that's not been my experience, but you know, again, my whenever I work with a DOP, my way to work is that you can always ask me a question at any time, I'll have the answer. And if I don't have the answer, I'll say, I don't have the answer. I won't make up some bullshit. I'll say, I don't have the answer. But if you give me a little bit of time to do the prep I need to do, I'll have the answer then. And so, you know, I think that's usually what people look for. If you understand light, you can help the DP as a director. Yeah. By actually putting some muscle in places the DP may not have muscle, like, for instance, over the scheduling. Like, one of the things for me is, you know, I'm very specific about light, and light is important because it's a huge tonal factor in any film, television, whatever it is. And so if I say, look, you know, we really need this low morning light, and I sit with my I have the agency to sit with my AD and say, look, you need to schedule this for a morning. This is a morning location because the sun's going to come up here and it's going to be there. By this time, the sun is going to be too high and everything's going to look flat. And we got to be out of there. And now a DP can make the same request. But if I'm also making that request, it has double the power and strength, and that way we'll let you end.
Right.
No, so usually my understanding of cinematography is generally embraced and accepted. And here's the other thing. If someone's got a better shot, I'm always open to see it too. And I'm clear about that.
Right.
I'm always,
that's another key too. Yeah. It's a collaborative sport, filmmaking.
Here's my storyboard, so here's the plan, and this is why, and this is where in the story this comes, and this is what happens before and afterwards, and so that's why it's this, and that's what I think. But now you know all that. If you've got on something else, I'm totally open to, you know, what that might be. But I think it's 75 right here that moves through here to here. And then, you know, sometimes you get suggestion, well, what about, you know, and then you listen to that through, and if that seems to be good, you go, okay, great, that's great. And particularly when you're working with DOPs of the like that I'm lucky enough to usually work with, you want that. You want them to come up with a better idea than yours, you know,
right.
Because, you know, then it frees up your mind to think about other things. But
right.
There is a very specific thing is that, you know, at the beginning in any film or television project that I'm doing, I sit down and I have a dream. I close my eyes and I dream that film. And I go into my own subconscious and I sit and I have that dream. And then I sit down and I do my best with pen and paper to do drawings of that dream. So I have this dream and it's a really clear one. And so it does look a specific way. So I am going to be 9 times out of 10 be defaulting to what I've seen in my head when I'm trying to get it.
Yeah, but, of course.
And again, I think it's that thing of, look, I've had, you know, I'm quite experienced. I've been doing this a long time and, you know, I've had enough time to make plenty of mistakes. And so, I generally always have a really good experience with the DOP and with all members of the crew, really.
Is your prep with your DOPs, is that the same on film and television?
Whatever it can be, you know, usually what happens is schedule and you know, budget dictate prep. So I just recently worked with Maddie Libatique. You know, I was commercial and we had enough prep time and we prepped together and everything went fine that way. A DOP I work with a lot who is Joel Willems, who shot my first two movies and he shot the pilot for American Gods with me and a number of things. And he and I have worked together for so long, we have such a shorthand that it's really easy. So we don't necessarily need as much prep. If that makes sense,
mm-hmm.
because we kind of read each other's minds and he's like, I'm
right.
You know, we'll walk into set and I'll go and he'll go. And then we won't have said anything, but we go, we'll walk out. And everyone else is like, wait for us. What's the shot? And I'm like, oh, okay. It's, you know,
that's hilarious.
So, you know, but that's, you know, I've been working with for 20 years. So I have an AD that I work with as well called Jay Arthur, who's been with me my whole career. You know, wherever I can, I use that crew. Because what you're trying to do, you know, is make a family, right? You're trying to get a family environment when you're working.
Right.
Because what you want to do is have a respectful, friendly, warm, fun place to be where everybody feels safe to do their best work. So that's what I'm always going for as a director, is like, particularly for actors, you know, I don't want you to feel insecure about any choice you might want to make. I need you to be free, know that you're in a very safe environment to work. And, you know, I spent my whole career figuring out all the wrong ways to do it, and it's come around to the right way, and the right way is to prepare absolutely everything, because you can forget your prep and change your mind on the day and do something that's more, that has more inspiration, and I live for that, you know. But because you've done the prep, you know why you're standing where you're standing. And when the actor asks a question about why they're going left rather than right, or whatever it might be, then you have the answer to that because you've prepped already and you know. And then there's the other thing, which is the human, you know, thing where, you know, on your, when you're shooting day one, you'll go, I don't remember anything. I have no idea what I'm doing here. But I've got all of these notes that I've written down because my brain, I'm completely human and I'm as scared shitless as everyone else is walking into a set, you know, and, you know, and if I wasn't, I'd be doing it wrong. So then I have notes and I go to my notes and I go, oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, so this is what I want to do. And that's how it works. So preparation, you know, preparation is, and then manners, you know. Being polite, it's, I think, gets you a long way.
When you're working with that, when you're working with a large group of people, that's super important.
Well, you've got to, you know, what you want to do also is, you know, you want to be treated the same way. You want other people to treat you the way you would be treated by. And you, I think it's important. I think that I do think it's, we're at a point also historically where people can get called out for, you know, not being polite. You should be. It's right. Just like any industry. You shouldn't be, oh, well, he's an asshole, but I don't buy that. I never really have. Like, oh, yeah, but he's really talented. No, well, then it's still, he's an asshole. That's the end of the day. Oh, geez, no. But you have to lead that way. You know, as a director, you're leading, even in television day to day, the showrunner may not be there, physically there, may not come to set, right? So you are the spearhead of whatever the thing is. So,
right.
If you're polite and you're friendly, then everyone else tends to be, I find, you know.
I would think so if the leader of the team is, yeah.
I think it's important, you know, which is not to say that, you know, people would confuse politeness with leniency. I'm also quite strict with what I'm after, and I know when I've got it, and I know when
I'm right. Let's switch to producing too, because you're also a producer, which is a completely different skill than directing. When you're producing a project, first off, let's start by defining a producer, because it's crazy how many people don't know what a producer actually does.
Do you? Because I don't know. I mean, that's a question. What does a producer do? Right?
I've always thought of a producer as the person that provides the tools. If the director is the painter, the producer provides the paintbrush, the canvas for them to paint on, you know?
Sure. Yeah, no, I mean, that's fine. I think most producers would think of themselves as being more creatively involved than that. As, you know, the best producers I've worked with are ones that come with, you know, filmmaking suggestions that are good ones as well.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, you know, you'll see various different hyphenated names in front of you. You have executive producer, you have line producer, and they all have different jobs. But a really good...
Is that what you do when you produce? You're more giving creative suggestions? And
if I'm producing, I'll probably be an executive producer, unless it's a movie that I've actually... helped get the finance for, which is something coming up, but isn't something that I've got in my career yet.
So,
a good producer will say, have you thought about doing it this way? And most people go, well, yeah, I did. And the reason I didn't want it was this. And, you know, or no, I haven't thought about it doing that way. Huh. And also the other thing about a producer, the difference between a producer and a director is often there is a, you know, there's always a discrepancy between time, money, and the dream that I had about the film I wanted to make, right? So if you're just bullheaded and you just go in demanding, you'll only get half your film anyway. So the best thing to do is go and talk. You know, I give you an example of, you know, I did a Black Mirror is not the biggest budget show in the world, but it's a good sized, you know, Netflix show. And we were doing the first episode I did, which was a black and white. I shot with a black and white camera. I had to convince the producers to go black and white, which took quite a lot of doing, but they went with it in the end. And then it became really apparent that I needed quite an expensive custom piece of gear, which is a thing called a pod. And a pod, what a pod is for people who don't know, is it's essentially what it's a stunt thing. And what you do is you take a car and you shift all of the gearing and all of the engine, and you reroute it to a stunt guy who's literally sat on the roof of the car. So if you're wide, you'll see a guy sat on the roof of the car. You've seen those things before, where there's a guy sitting on the roof of the car. So what that does is it makes the precision driver of the car a stunt guy, which means the actor is no longer driving the car. A stunt guy is driving the car.
Right.
Which makes a lot of things very, very much, much safer. And the only way I shoot is if it's safely. You know, so, but we didn't have the money entirely. So I had to go to the producer and say, well, we have this number of days. We really need the pod. So I'm going to give you back a day here. Does that do it? Will that pay for, you know? And so that's the, and they said, well, yes, but there's also this other thing too, which is also a thing you probably wouldn't understand, would cost a lot of money, but it is doing, because you're shooting in a location that's charging a lot. If we could shift that location to here. And that's creative producing. They made very good suggestions that I took on board, and then I came back of shooting, and then I got my pod, and I got all the other things I need, and I shot a really good episode, and I was really proud of it. So, you know, a creative producer will be a help to you, and it won't just be about getting the paint, you know, there, but also about, you know, making sure that it's not just on there on time, but it's done and it dries properly, and then it's preserved afterwards, you know.
Yeah.
All the analogies. So, you know, and again, a producer for me as an executive producer on Hannibal, for instance, you know, that might extend to all manner of things, from talking with directors, just make sure they have any questions about how the pilot was directed and how, you know, or whatever they might want to do, whether it fits the show, whether it doesn't fit the show, to going and doing pickup shooting, where I would go down and actually shoot little bits and pieces for other people's episodes, help get that extra little shot that you know that is done as an insert shot later on. We do quite a bit of that, and then really just being a quality control person who stays on, like for instance on Hannibal. I sound mixed every single episode of all three seasons, which means So, the beginning of it, I was working with Brian Reitzel, who I worked with on my second movie, 30 Days of Night, who I love working with, and who was exactly the right composer and who's done amazing things with the show Hannibal, things that couldn't have been done without him. And he agreed to come on and do the pilot on a television schedule, because he was used to, you know, he'd done at that point a bunch of films with Sofia Coppola and my film and a few other things. And he said, look, you know, I'm worried about the mix. I'll do every episode if you promise me that if I can't get to the mix, you'll go to the mix and supervise the mix. So I said, okay, deal. And then he couldn't get to it. I ended up mixing every episode, you know, and mixing in association with Brian Fuller and you know, the showrunner and all the rest of it. But I would be the one that would go there and mix and be really hands-on mixing. So, you know, and that's not always the case, you know. Different producers do different things. But I have a lot of chops in the mixed sound mixing world, so it made sense. I was able to mix in a good amount of time and really mix well. So, so that would be something that would be quite unusual, I think, for a producer to do. But yeah, I sound mixed every episode of that show. For example,
that's interesting.
Yeah.
So you have a pretty broad broad understanding of all of the filmmaking process then? Where did you learn all of that?
When I was a kid, I wanted to go to film school and I couldn't get in anywhere. Everyone rejected me. So, you know, I went to London Film School and a place like that. I couldn't get in anyway. So I ended up just doing a degree in fine art, which was more kind of like, you can paint if you want, you can draw, you can, you know, use this camera equipment if you can figure out how to work it, because we don't. So I would just have to learn, you know. And so it's self-taught. You know, I just I would teach myself and I would read as much as I could on any subject, and I'd learn by doing. You know, my film school was music videos that I did a lot of.
Yeah.
Directed a lot of music videos from 1998 to 2004 or whatever. I did tons of music videos and commercials. Not so many commercials, but more music videos, and those became my film school as well. So it's funny, when I did my first film, Hard Candy, the first day of shooting, there was a producer who kept talking about line theory. You know, I was like, line theory, okay, what's line theory? I don't know. So when I wrapped my first day of shooting, I went and got a book on, you know, like a directing book, and I was like, line theory. Okay, so looking left, you know, this way, you know, that way, right. Oh, yeah, I know that. Okay, so, but I had no idea.
You had no idea what it was called.
I knew how to do it, but I didn't know what the name for it was. If I'd gone to film school, I would have gone, yeah, it's fine. It's definitely. The question was like, well, is he looking in the right direction? Because somebody, you know, and the answer I would have given was that you know, no, he's looking neutral because it's important that they're neutral, because this is not as confrontational, and this is, and that way it's tied to the eye line, and all the stuff that, yeah, but I just hadn't heard it, because I didn't go to film school. I wasn't told the name for it, right? So,
right.
Know, it's one of those things where, like, I kind of instinctively knew, although eye lines is a thing that camera operators are the ones that really know. They know, no matter how much you think you know about, you know, eye lines, it's always the camera operator who knows. Right. You know, exactly. You know, will tell you, you know, if it's something fishy going on and that stuff. But yeah, just by doing, by making a lot of mistakes, making a bunch of really crap work as well, and then getting better and learning from mistakes, and trying not to be afraid of making mistakes, but trying not to make the same mistake. You know, that's been my film school. Yeah.
So it's basically just been the process of filmmaking that taught you everything. Yeah.
But also watching films, you know, which is important too. I don't watch anywhere near as many films as some directors do. I have films that I love, but I'm not, a film buff in many ways. I love the process of making more than often the process of watching. There are people who have these incredible, like, you speak to Quentin Tarantino, he knows every single thing about every single film ever made under a certain period of time, right? And so Quentin, I'm not that guy. I don't have that enormous breadth of knowledge of other people's work. I study the filmmakers I love, you know, I've really read it and watch their work, but I don't have that big, broad, you know. I think Edgar Wright, for instance, somebody I know as well, who I think probably has a much broader knowledge of film than I do. But I know enough to get by, and I have the filmmakers that I really love, and the ones I've really followed, and the ones that I've really seen, and they tend to be strange or weird or odd films that I tend to like. Like, for instance, I've seen every Paul Schrader movie. I love Paul Schrader's movies as a filmmaker. Yeah. But I don't necessarily know some of the bigger names, some of the really big famous filmmakers from other periods, you know. It's that thing of, like, you know, with being self, if you're self-taught, there's also a limit to have what you teach yourself, and you tend to teach yourself what you think is fun yourself, rather than, you know, I never had to go to a film class and watch a movie I didn't want to watch, right? So as a result of that, my view is somewhat narrow, but also, you know, quite precise.
Do you see that as a benefit to your filmmaking, not having that broad view or broad knowledge of other people's work, or is it more of a hindrance for you?
Oh, God, that's a really good question. See, I wouldn't say either, quite frankly, but I don't know what the good answer to that question is. I mean, in the sense that, you know, I have my own way of shooting, and I take photographs, and I'm very precise about making an image, and I'm very precise about all the prep that goes into it. I don't think I would be biased by seeing another film. Yet at the same time, if I've really enjoyed loads and loads of films, I may have seen things that are, so it's actually six, one half dozen the other, really. I don't know. It's a great question, that. And I don't really, I couldn't land on either side of that question. I would say, you know, I wish I'd seen every movie, you know, I wish I'd seen every movie that I've seen, you know, and I knew it, and knew it, and I had an encyclopedic recall as he does, but I don't, you know. Right. Yeah, at the same time, sometimes, you know, I really enjoy being focused on one thing and not having the distraction of, you know, also there's the phrase, the comparison is the thief of joy, right? You know that phrase? So comparison is the thief of joy, right? So, like, if you're like, oh, God, man, what are you trying to be, David Lean with this shot? Then, you know, I imagine that would steal some pleasure from what I'm doing, and I tend not to compare myself to others because I find that to be, yeah, I really enjoy what I do. I don't want to, you know, there's always going to be someone way better than you are at what you do. So
you're not the type of director that's like making a whole bunch of references to other filmmakers in your films then?
Not generally speaking, no. I am not the kind of director who I really, yeah, I've been asked to do this. And some people find this really useful, and it's not something I do. And it's just the way I work. I don't say, well, let's pull up a bunch of references from films and talk about a shot. Let's talk about this shot from this film, and I'm going for something like this shot. So this, but I will, you know, I will talk tonally, you know, about somatic language, you know, and say things that are useful, that is referential to other films. You know, I'm trying to think of a good example because that sounds really kind of trite on its own. But,
when you're talking about tone, when you're talking about let's use the pilot for Hannibal as an example. When you're speaking about tone for that, what are you trying to get across to everybody working on the project?
Yeah, weight. The thing about Hannibal was weight. The thing about the character. And the conversation I had with Mads Mikkelsen was, he is a godlike presence. He knows everything, and it's simple. It's really simple. You know, he is an omniscient, right? That's the only real piece of direction I ever gave Mads, was he knows, and he's unstoppable. And everything everybody else knows, he knows. Right. So,
but that's so good what you just did right there. That said everything that needed to be said, but it was so concise, you know?
Yeah. You tend to find ways, you know, try and prepare in ways that, because, you know, the cardinal sin to me is limiting someone's imagination. Don't do that. Don't limit someone's imagination. Don't be so specific that they're not going to, you know, bring you all of the amazing things that they are. Right. So particularly you've got someone like Mads Mikkelsen, right, or Brian Fuller for that matter, who is just a fountain of images. You know, he has 100,000 images he wants, and he sees, and I want them too.
Right.
So right. I just, you know, and then I suggest other things, you know, and and suggest more and suggest more, and just being really optimistic about how to get it done, and also being very precise about how getting it done, how to get it done, and how to make it look real by doing it as physically as possible so that it feels real, because it, and then it looks real because it feels real. And then, you know, life is always the thing, you know. If you ask a director what they're looking for, you've been asking me, what are you looking for my whole career? And I've finally found the answer, and the answer was life, right? So I'm looking for life. That's the thing. Life and whatever
it be. That's a great answer. I always say life and truth, the truth of love, life, whatever that truth may be.
The truth is so tricky, right? Because, you know.
Well, that's the good part for me. Like the ambiguity of truth, like the two characters' truths in the same project are completely different, you know? So what is the truth for this character? What is the truth?
In film, truth is a thing you kind of feel. It's a physical thing almost, you know, or a spiritual thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the truth of a performance is something that is a feeling, and it's tonal too, and you can influence that as a director if you have the right words. But you can also trip an actor up if you have the wrong words. And, you know, I try to just get out of the way. Mostly my, as a director working with amazing actors, you know, you talk about your expectations, and then you just try and get the hell out of that way, because there's no way I'm going to, you know, make a better decision than an actor. It is the actor that we managed to cast.
I think it was Paul Thomas Anderson that said he doesn't really even direct his actors anymore. He writes them a good script, and then from that, it's all about telling them to do more or less.
How do you get these performances? And I think that my first job is to be a really good writer to the actors.
You know?
Yeah. No, I think what you do as a director is you're trying to cast exactly the person that is. You're trying to cast the actor who is exactly the person in the script, which is not possible. But that's what you try and do. And then you get out of the way, you know, or you encourage them, or you find a way of talking to them that makes a scaffold, or you will find a way if they're open to a way of working. I just worked with an actor who really enjoyed, you know, I would use metaphorical direction rather than specific. And that was... It was really useful because it allowed him to do anything he wanted to. So I could say to that actor, and I wouldn't say this to every actor, but we talked about this, and they were saying, okay, you're a black hole. And that's all there is. And, you know, some actors would go tell you to fuck yourself. What the hell does that mean? I can't work with that. What do I do? But this actor liked that, and that was useful. And some actors, and every actor is different too, and people come from different schools, and, you know, it's not just method and whatever. There's all kinds. There's as many different styles of acting as there are actors. So what I try and do is when I meet the actors, I try to figure out how they like to work, and then try and facilitate that too. You know, and I had a lot of fun on that film because a number of the actors were really open to metaphorical direction, you know.
Right.
You know, it's like, there's a weight.
You're a black hole.
There's a weight and there's an inertia. And it's, you know, and it's just creeping up on you. But it's made of broken glass, right? So, I don't know. You know. Or you could say it's, you know, because what you're trying to do is get them to feel it. Right? Where is it?
Right.
Here's here.
Right.
Because that's what, you know, that's what life is. So,
yeah.
And some actors just want to know left or right, avoid the furniture. Great. Leave it to me. And that's good.
Yeah.
For me. I'm totally cool with that as well, you know.
What's that process like for you? Like finding out what the actor likes, you know, because every, like you said, every actor has a different style, a different process. So when you're working with, you know, three actors in a scene and they all have different processes, how do you find out how to communicate to them? And then how are you communicating to all of them individually?
It's preparation again. You know, you spend as much time as you can with those actors beforehand and rehearsal, which is unheard of. You know, it's a thing where, you know, I find a rehearsal really useful. Some of the directors don't like to rehearse. A lot of directors famously don't like to rehearse because they think you're stealing something that could be the first time something happens in front of a camera, which I think is also fair. But I like rehearsing, and I don't over rehearse. I only rehearse a little bit, but I like rehearsing just to get a sense, to do a number of things, to ask, get all of the questions answered, if possible, while the money clock is not running. Right. So, you know, you
yeah.
You know, rehearsal is just you and a bunch of actors in a room, you can just, is that what you think that means? Oh, that's really interesting, because I'm not sure that that's what I think it means. Let's figure this out. You know, my interpretation is this, but I'd like to hear yours. You don't have that time, but you have that time in rehearsal. And to me, rehearsal is never about performance. I think it's an important thing.
No, yeah.
Rehearsal is about figuring out the mistakes we could make and trying to avoid them and figuring out how to give, and particularly how to give your actor as much freedom as possible. You know, and that goes to what you were saying earlier about you might have three people with different styles. And by giving one actor tons of freedom, you might end up restricting another actor. So that's another balancing act you have to figure out how to use, right? So, you know, yeah. I had one actor once who's like, I want to go last on every take. And I'm like, no, you can't go last. That's mean to all the other actors, because what you're doing
right now, you're trying to,
how you're doing it, you know, while you're getting 100 rehearsals. And that's unfair to everyone else. So you can't go last. That's not fair. I'm not going to let you do that. You can every now and again, but we're going to rotate, you know. So anyway. Life. It all comes down to life. That's what it is. It's the life in the show.
I like that.
Performance is the life.
I like life better than truth, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, truth is tricky, you know, because when you talk about truth, often people think of an object, something objectivity, and there's nothing objective about cinema. You know, there's nothing at all. There's nothing really even that objective about perception, quite frankly, but particularly in cinema, where you're looking through a lens, through a thing, at a set, there's no objectivity there at all. Everything's subjective. Everything's entirely subjective. So what's the truth? You know, well, you know, I tend to like the films where the truth is interpretive. I'm a huge David Lynch fan, for instance. I'm a huge fan of David Lynch. Lynch, you know, I'm pretty certain would not want to tie you down to one interpretation. And I think it's
right
that opens doors. I try to not close the doors, but I'll have a very specific point of view, right? So, you know, it's a thing of, again, truth, you know, Godard called it 24 frames per second, truth at 24 frames per second. At one point, I called it lies at 24 frames per second. If you're doing a visual effects movie, where's the truth in that? Like, you know, I mean, you have to find another way to get to it, which might be spiritual or emotional. Like, imagine James Cameron doing Avatar, you know, with people in leotards with dots on their faces. They get to a truth, though. There's some astonishing
differences
there. But it's not through, you know, being in a place, and some people find the place itself to be very important too. So you've got to find your truth in whatever way you can, and it's a subjective truth, and it might be a lie to somebody else, and you've got to be all right with that too. you got to believe. But it's important as a filmmaker to have faith, not spiritually, but to have the faith in the material and know your own truth. You don't have to tell anybody what that is. You don't have to say anything to anybody about what you think it is.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. Anyway.
Just based on what you're the way you're speaking, I really want to know who your favorite director is.
That's, oh, really?
Like, you're, because you're very
yeah.
You have a very specific style in everything that I've seen you do, but you also have speaking to you right now, you have a very specific take on cinema.
Yeah.
And I want to know, like, what that influence is.
So the way I answer that question is to be a little wishy-washy and to say that it changes. When I first was learning about cinema, because I didn't go to film school, because I have, you know, everything I did was self-taught. The filmmakers that stood out to me were the ones that made me sit up and go, wait a minute. So I would put David Lynch on that list for sure. We've already talked about Lynch. You know, and also, you know, David comes from a film background, an art background. I also come from an art background, you know. There's that.
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw Eraserhead. That was like,
but not real.
I was like, can you do something like this? Like,
Yeah, exactly. So that, so there's that thing, which is where it's a response. I mean, I'm a big fan of that person because it's a response to my awakening of my knowledge of cinema. And so Stanley Kubrick, of course, you know, would be the first. And, you know, 2001: A Space Odyssey, which was made the year before I was born and was made the year before the moon landing, which is the year I was born. And it still has the best visual effects of
any. It does, doesn't it? Right?
It holds up, you know?
Yeah, it does. It's
but
crazy.
But more than that, it had this existential spiritual subtext, you know?
Mm.
And it still continues to have meaning and seems to reinvent itself. It's a film that I can watch every year. I watched it a few weeks ago, and I had a few glasses of wine. And I remember I drunk tweeted it. But I was crying. I was crying at one point watching it because it was just such a beautiful thing. But then this notion that, you know, you have the closing sequence where the Sentinel is there, the Sentinel is in the room, and, you know, which is just this complete fabrication, this room. And he's sitting there and he's having dinner and he's eating his dinner and he's watching himself and he's looking over himself on the bed and then goes over to the, and we go over to the bed and then he's a dying man in the bed and then he's going to become the Star Child. And it's about time, and time is something that, you know, quite recently in science, the fundamental nature of science, of time is something that is being questioned right now. And again, it makes me think of 2001: A Space Odyssey, because whether he knew it or not, Kubrick got it right with Arthur C. Clarke when he did that. You know, time is not necessarily a linear nonstop thing. And this is before we get into, you know, Christopher Nolan's experiments with the science of time. So that's a huge film to me. Paul Schrader's films, I guess because he's a Calvinist to some extent, is a really distinct and very unusual point of view to have.
Yeah.
And I saw it in Taxi Driver, which is Scorsese's directed, but it's Paul Schrader's script.
Paul Schrader's script, yeah.
And this notion that you cannot have something for yourself, you know, it's just an alien thing. So I think that's really fascinating. So Schrader, I love Scorsese, of course. Scorsese is every filmmaker's filmmaker.
Yeah. He's every filmmaker's favorite filmmaker, yeah, for sure.
Because he's such a, and again, it's like Tarantino, who I also have great respect for. He has this huge encyclopedic knowledge of cinema, which I don't have. But Nicholas Roeg was a very big influence on me when I was
interesting
out. Because again, Nick was doing things with editing and with time that were like, you watch Hitchcock, right? Everybody watches Hitchcock, and I love Hitchcock too. I have a favorite Hitchcock movie. It's Vertigo. But it's a very straight way of doing things. And it often, you know, you see quoted that Hitchcock said that the filming of the film was the least interesting part to him, because he would storyboard the hell out of it, and the processes was what he was interested in. Nicholas Roeg was a cinematographer who was just very experimental with time. And I think it's really fascinating. And it opened doors to me that I thought didn't realize I even had locks on them, you know. So a film like Performance, which stars Edward Fox in a career-making performance, and Mick Jagger, The Man Who Fell to Earth, another film that I love passionately, you know. So my wishy-washy bit is saying you gave me a number, and I think I've probably already gone over the number of films that I've.
No. I love it. I love it. It helps me understand your direction.
Think about
a little
The Man
bit
Who Fell to Earth as well. I have this particular, you know, it's based on a book, which is a brilliant book. I love. There's something that happens when Nicholas Roeg works with David Bowie that is untouchable. But the book's a really good book. the book itself, you know, Walter Tevis, who was also, he was an alcohol addict and had all kinds of problems. And he was also responsible for the Queen's Gambit. He also wrote The Hustler. He was, you know, tremendous writer. But then what Nicholas Rogue did was something very different, where they took a linear story and twisted it on its head and turned it around. It had a man who fell to earth. There's all kinds of experimental things going on at a time when the norm was Hitchcock, right? So I don't know. I think that I find that very, very interesting. I found him, I found Rogue to be very interesting because it made me question and it made me excited about the form. It also, and Lynch did this too, made me realize that mise-en-scene is the term we use. It means, you know, in theater, it's a term that means all of the things that you use, right? From lighting to sets, to props, to mise-en-scene, the stuff you use in theater. And it's in cinema, it's used differently because of the, it's used often in relation to editing. Many years ago, there was Eisenstein who had montage, which was a very hard way of cutting, mm-hmm. and there was mise-en-scene, which has suggestion within it. But mise-en-scene is, I use it as a, all of the stuff, right? Just the mass makes up a movie. All of the stuff. And it drew my attention to the influence that the form actually had over the content and how much the subconscious was on view. So, and that fascinates me. You know, I believe that the subconscious is the thing that we all understand without talking about it. And so if you think of the films of David Lynch, to some degree, Nicholas Rogue, the subconscious is very much on view. I mean, you know, Eraserhead blew my mind because it's a nightmare. Is it a nightmare? No, actually, a reinterpretation. I'm sure there are Jungian and Freudian interpretations of Eraserhead. It's about the subconscious. It's about all the thoughts that make up a person, because a person isn't just the shell of the outside of the decisions they make. It's all of the internal that is a secret to everyone else, too. So I find that fascinating. And while my films don't have that much of that in them, I'm always interested in that. I think Look, Bandersnatch was a good example, which was the Black Mirror Choose Your Own Adventure episode that I did with Charlie Brooker, where I was brought in very early in the prep process before the script was written. And I was able to, nudge Charlie in the direction of dreams. And to allow, to make the dreams as relevant as the actions, or blur the two so that each had the same weight. An actor could go into a dream and it could have the same amount of objectivity as a scene with his dad sitting at a table, drinking a cup of tea and reading a book, for instance, and that was something that fascinates me, because cinema is that one of those places, very few places, where we can deal with the subconscious, and it just drives us a lot more than we like to admit it does.
That's literally what
we did 2001 Space Odyssey. Nicholas Rogue's performance, we did generally Scorsese and Schrader. Jim Jarmusch's film, Down by Law, is a film I absolutely adore.
I just watched that again like last week. Yeah, I was doing a Robbie Mueller introspective. I was kind of just going through some of his best work.
Oh, Wings of Desire.
And Down... Oh, man. Right.
Wim Wenders was very important to me as well. Jim Jarmusch was very important to me as a film, as what I was learning with Wim, and Wings of Desire was astonishing. An American Friend. These are films that I really spoke to me,
American Friend too. Yeah.
Yeah. Down by Law, man.
Jim Jarmusch and Spike Lee were sort of the forebearers of the independent cinema movement that kind of still to this day inspires me, what they were able to do with so little.
Yeah. I think it was a moment in, I think it was clockers. I remember he does this, just the tracking thing, right, where the actor's standing on a tracking board and tracking along. I'm just going, that's so fucking powerful. That's powerful. I've never seen that before. And, you know, I do. I love Spike Lee's films too, as well. Yeah. It came later to me. It was funny. I was in England where there was a lot of European cinema. So, you know, film vendors and things like that, those were easier to find. Actually, Alejandro Jodorowsky, who did El Topo and Holy Mountain and Santa Sangre, which is one of, which was a film that just blew my mind out of my head and down the cinema aisle. I had its jaw and nose and an ear, and I had to kind of put it all back together after I saw that movie. Jodorowsky was a huge influence as well. And then recently, I still watch movies. I love movies. Bernardo's film Mandy with Nicolas Cage. It was a film that I absolutely adored. It's a few years back now, but relatively recent. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I haven't actually, but it's on my list, and everybody keeps telling me to watch it. I hear it's really beautiful, and I've seen clips, and the colors are super vibrant.
To me, there's a connection between Jodorowsky and Panos. It's the spiritual way of going into something, and possibly a lot of large substances used are a big part of it as well. And I think that is also, there's a certain amount of just mind freeing that is not necessarily to do with drug use, but to do with not thinking as clearly and objectively. Listen, I like Spielberg too and everything, but I'm a fan of most filmmakers, but there's something really enjoyable about a Spielberg film. But the cinematic aspect of it, to me, is now, if you look at the early films like Jewel, for instance, which is a phenomenal film, and Jaws and so on, there's been there's a much more human aspect and much more objective aspect to Spielberg's films. So I tend to kind of respect that. We just saw The Fablemans, and I thought it was beautiful. But I tend to enjoy more the kind of, left of field work, I think. And to some extent, I'm always looking for something new and something that I wouldn't have thought of, right? As well. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm looking for when I'm going out to watch a movie or find an old movie, or whatever it is.
Yes. Something to surprise you who's been watching movies your entire life.
Yeah, no. If I see something like that's what happened with Mandy. Mandy blew me away. I was like, "Fuck!"
You're gonna make me watch Mandy tonight.
Yeah, you gotta watch it. It's awesome. I mean, it's just, he takes it. It's a film about vengeance. It's an acid trip of a film about vengeance, but it's a film about vengeance. He's taken the genre of the vengeance movie, which is a genre, and just done the most extreme version of the film about vengeance. And it's just psychedelic and astonishing and uses amazing language. And I loved it. My theory of cinema is to do a dream, is that we all dream. And in those that dreaming is our understanding of the code of cinema. And so that's why you understand so many things about certain films, I think, explicitly without having to talk it through, you feel it, right? And there's something about the human aspect of dreaming that is human, right? There's nothing more human than dreaming. We all do it,
There's nothing. Everybody dreams, yeah.
So, not just aspirational dreams, but generally speaking, it's a thing that makes us human. So if you're communicating in a language that is known by humans, then surely it allows more empathy. I don't know. I would guess. That's what I think. Anyway, I think that dream narratives allow a certain amount of inherent empathy because you understand it, right? Inherently. So I don't know. I may be talking a lot of rubbish too.
No, I think that's beautiful. I think that's, what's the film that you said is about to come out next year, you said?
It's one.
Do you mind talking about it?
It's one I don't really want to talk about too much because when we're making the film, MGM, the studio got bought by Animalism, and we don't know what. And so what happened was once the got absorbed into the whale, so it's somewhere in the whale. So I don't know yet. I don't want to say anything in fear of just not getting it right because we don't know. We know that it's
right.
We know that they've only just appointed a head of MGM, so we're going to eventually that person gets around to, I'll sit with that person and we'll go back to the film. But there's a finished studio cut of it. I'm expecting it's a Halloween movie. I'm expecting it's going to come out Halloween next year. But yeah, it's called Dark Harvest. It's based on a book by the same title. And
you've already shot it, right?
It's shot, posted and finished. The director's cut's not done, but the studio cut's done. So it's, you know, there's a good version of it, that is ready to go in the cinemas when MGM and Amazon sort their stuff out. And, that's all I know. That's why I don't really want to talk about it. Cause I don't, when it comes out,
that makes sense. Yeah.
I talk about it in great detail. But it's a weird, I can tell you the premise of it. It is it's a period film set in 1962 and 63, about a small farming community where every Halloween night, all of the kids 18 and over, all of the young men, although one of them is a girl, go out, dressed up for Halloween to kill and eat the local monster who, if he gets to the church by midnight, will lay waste to the town. And the last time it happened was the Dust Bowl, right? So that they have to every year. It's a fun monster movie, period.
Right.
Drama.
Interesting.
Yeah, there's nothing much like it. It's really weird. That's next year. That'll come out this year, rather. It'll come out probably October, I think, if it's coming out.
This year, 2023.
Yeah. My best guess and everyone's best guess right now until the dust settles with the studio that was bought in the middle of the process is Halloween this year.
Yeah.
So, but
how do you navigate working with studios, both large and small?
Yeah, I don't know. I just trying to be honest all the time, and try and figure out what everyone's agenda is and just try and not hide things because that never works, just try and speak to everybody, figure out what everybody wants. It's a difficult one though. I feel like Twilight was good and we got on really well and everything was fine. And 30 Days of Night was also fine. I don't know. It's difficult. I don't want to be disparaging about film studios. It's just a different process, having not gone to film school, it's a whole other thing that the negotiation skills, I call it, the hostage negotiating that goes on, is a different thing.
Do you find that explaining what you want tends to work or explaining the reasoning behind
tends to work? I mean, you'd never know with a studio. It's different because it's a whole institution, right? It's there are people who have more knowledge than you do about film. And there are people who don't, and you may get three of them, and they may have all different levels of film, and they may not like what you're doing, or they may like what you're doing, but not understand what you're doing. So you just try and do your best at, very be true to what you set out to do and make the film that you set out to do and be as friendly as you can. You get to the end of your movie and everybody loves you and everyone's your friend, your movie's probably shit though. It was a studio movie.
Yeah, that's how it
that
goes.
Thing of like, you got to stand your ground, but you know, you're trying. I try and, because I'm old enough and mature enough to be able to stand my ground in a way that's pleasant and not confrontational, because I don't know that's anything. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, what you try and do is like you do always, you try and assemble the cast and crew of people at the studio in the same way you would your cast and crew. You try and reach out to the people who will see things the way you do, and that's how you get a, have a good experience and you work well. You know, and you try not to be confrontational in ways that are when someone's going to see something very, very differently. You know, it's like film testing is a thing that gets to me. You know, when they go and they test the film at a mall, you invite a bunch of people in. That's the harder part of it. It's when you go, and I've gone through that a few times. That I find difficult as a filmmaker, because it just doesn't make any sense to me. But studios do it, and yeah, that's part. If you're doing a studio movie, that's part of what you're going to be doing at some point. So that's a hard one for me, I find. Without being disparaging,
You hear all these horror stories about filmmakers working with studios and studio interference and everything like that. It's got to be frustrating to even have that kind of relationship, that kind of animosity with a studio. Not saying that you have had that.
No, I really haven't had that much of that at all. Honestly, I've had good experiences, most by and large, really good experiences. But you know, again, you get. I've been doing this, and I've done like 4, 5, including this last one, movies over a number of years, and I would have been better at the negotiation process. I'm better now than I was at the beginning of my career. So it's everything. Everybody changes over time, and you know. So you kind of, you don't, as a director, also you don't get to see how other directors work. It's something you do. It's very private. You do it yourself. So I you do it by yourself, and you, so you don't get to witness those kind of confrontations other people have with people. I try not to have confrontations with people. I don't think it tends to lead to anything positive. You tend to try and, it's that whole thing of, you know, like you have to stand by what you planned out to do, but at the same time, just ask politely, you know, make sure everyone's okay. And you'll get way more of it than if you just bulldoze your way through, I think, anyway. I mean, I think generally that's just a life lesson, though, about everything in life, not just film studios or television networks or commercials, clients. You know, it's a similar thing. You know, you have people who are coming in and they have different knowledge to you, and they may have different agendas to you, and you have to figure out what that stuff is so that you can make sure that they feel comfortable. And in many ways, it's like that to you. Like, you want them to feel like they can say anything at any time, but you don't want them to derail the vision you have, right? So it's a tough mission to pull. But yeah, I don't have like a big story like that, really. And honestly, I don't think many filmmakers don't like to talk about those big stories anyway, because then you it brings you across as a victim, and that's not the way I see myself anyway.
Yeah.
So
how do you feel? How do you feel about the status of the studios and the streamers, and both with film and television? And how they're operating now, and you know, the money that they've been throwing at films is starting to slow down. Films and television is starting to slow down now. Do you think that's
it's cyclical and changing? And there's been a lot of change. But by and large, there's a pattern that, if you look at things, is makes sense. You know, there's also a thing about imaging, and you know, we're now beginning to see advances in technology where computers are doing really, 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 really good images. About stable diffusion and AI technologies. And so what's happened, you know, in the history of the arts is that each advance in technology, and I'll bring this back to the question in a minute, but each advance in the technology marginalizes the last version. So like just the simple version of what I mean by that is, you know, when there was no photography, a lot of people made a living and a good living painting portraits and painting. And then along came a photographer, and then that was a skill in itself, but it was just, but it's an exposure and it's a series of things, which now what happens is it's marginalized the painters, because only the really good painters can get work, because a lot of medium, not so good, but copy, but getting better painters can't get worked in portraits anymore because the guy's taking photographs, and that's, so that marginalizes that. And then you get to moving images, computer film, your visual effects, you get CGI, which then, you know, kind of has the knock-on effect of, well, now you have these massive movies with great spectacle, which I love. But that marginalizes the dramas. So now,
right,
if you're going to go to a big screen, well, why are you going to a big screen? To see a great big spectacle, right? So where's the drama? Well, it's largely by and large on TV. So there seems to be a pattern to it, to me, that you know, quite frankly, I'm surprised it took this long. And I think, honestly, what will happen is the studios will merge together and the streamers will merge together, and there'll be, you know, fewer and fewer of them. And then you have this whole new thing that's coming on, which is this artificial intelligence machine learning, where you have prompt-driven image engines that are making amazing images. And they're not moving yet, but they will soon. there's script writing software too, that, you know, people are using, and it's, you know, again, that's going to marginalize further. So again, to me, there's nothing new here. It's just each imaging system and each technological system marginalizes the previous. You got to learn. You got to learn again. And if you don't learn, then you get left behind. And I think I think that's the patterns we're seeing in streaming. It just makes sense to, you know, reach as many people as you possibly can on as many different devices as you possibly can. So that's going to overtake the film studio system. I don't see how it can't. And eventually, now, you know, if you go to a multiplex, there'll be a couple of screens where they'll show movies that are dramas, but mostly it'll be the larger, bigger spectacle movies, and that's which really kind of are crying out to be seen on huge screens. And that's just a combination of economics and evolution, right? To me, you know, that's just the way it is. I don't think there's any fault in any of it. You know, we've had spectacles movies since the beginning of time, but you know, now we can watch a movie on our Apple Watch if we want to. You know, although it's kind of Apple Watch, and you can send an AVI file to it, and I can watch a movie on it. But I mean, that's bullshit.
Yeah,
nobody should ever do that. I'm just
being nobody. Silly. Definitely, nobody should ever do that.
Nobody should ever do that. I'm being silly. But you know, for instance, though, I don't like this at all. But you know, working in London, you'll see people going to work on the tube in the morning on the underground train, watching a TV show on their phone. You know.
Yeah.
And who am I to say don't do that? You know. But
right. Yeah. Well, the way I see that is, it's like if Leonardo da Vinci were to paint the Sistine Chapel, and then he would paint an equivalent painting on a street wall, it would still be a work of art by Leonardo da Vinci. You know what I mean? Sure. No matter what the medium, or if he painted something on a t-shirt, you know, it would still be a Leonardo da Vinci painting. The medium of consumption may change, but the artist is still there behind the work, you know?
Yeah, to some extent, you know, there's the 100,000 hours of it all, of like, you know, the more time you spend perfecting a specific thing, the better you get at it. That's the thing that's going to become kind of interesting in the next few years, I think, because like it doesn't take an AI 100,000 hours to be as good at painting. Then DiCaprio now. But AI isn't a magical genie. AI is a data set that is made by people, that is organized by people, right. It's created by You know, the imaging diffusion models came from people wanting to do, saying, well, this thing that's happening with scientific data, can we do it with images? And so it wasn't even specifically designed, you know, to begin with as an imaging tech. And the answer was, yes, there's a way to do that. We'll do it with diffusion, with image referencing and diffusion. And, you know, again, artists will continue to make art through that, but there'll be a certain amount of marginalization, you know, in the same way that big CGI spectacle movies have led to a certain marginalization of smaller movies on big screens, you know, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, television is becoming more the place you see drama, and you go out to the cinema to buy a great big tub of popcorn and watch a Marvel movie or whatever, or a DC movie, or, you know, Christopher Nolan movie or whatever, what have you. Again, it's just, to me, I see the pattern, you know. Yeah.
No, that makes sense. That actually is a very interesting way of looking at it. I think your analogy, or your, not analogy, but your reference with the painters and the photographers, that's a perfect way to look at it. You know,
yeah, I mean, filmmaking is a very, it's really hard to make a film. Like, I don't know how hard it was to send a man to the moon, but I can't imagine it'd be much harder than making a movie. It's really hard. And if you appreciate how hard it is, then, you know, it's a thing that it helps to understand how hard it is and see how hard everybody's working on it. It's not an easy thing to do. There are easier jobs to have. So you've chosen to take this job, so you can't complain about the hard work. You know?
Right.
So, you know, to a certain extent, I just feel really lucky to be in this position, and I don't want to really jeopardize it too much, because I know how difficult it is to send a man to the moon or make a movie. And I feel very privileged to do it. And that never leaves me, that feeling of privilege as well, that, like, you know, I could be working for a living, which would be way worse. I'd hate that.
Yeah. Here at Film Crux, we're known for helping filmmakers take their films and videos to the next level, which is why we're proud to announce Film Crux Plus. Every Film Crux product for just $10 a month. Sound design, Foley, cinematic music, VFX assets, and more, all in one place. Your films will never be the same.